The following is a presentation of Second City Works, delivered by your earbuds at WGN Plus.
Welcome to the Second City Works, Getting to Yes And. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Applied Improvisation for the world-famous Second City Theater. This is more than just a podcast. It's about getting to the Yes And moment in your work and in your life. Yes And is a key pillar of improvisation. It operates at the front end of creativity. It's about building on ideas and navigating change. This is Getting to Yes And.
Working all day for a mean little man with a clip on tie and a rub on tan. He's got me running around the office like a dog around a track. But when I get back home, you're always there to rub my back.
My guest today on Getting to Yes And is Samina Mustafa. Samina is running for the United States Congress to represent the 5th District of Illinois. She was born in Evanston to Indian immigrant parents moving to the Edgebrook neighborhood of Chicago. She has lived in the 5th District for 30 years, currently living in the North Center neighborhood. She is a graduate of Chicago Public Schools and Northwestern University. Samina has dedicated her life and career to standing up for those unable to stand up for themselves. She's managed Planned Parenthood's Austin Area Clinic. She serves on advisory boards for Chicago Public Media and Chicago Women's Health Center. She founded Hand Her the Mic, an organization dedicated to empowering women of color through comedy, and co-founded her own diverse comedy troupe, Simmer Brown. Samina was selected as a 2017 National Leadership Academy Fellow by the Asian Pacific American Institute for Congressional Studies in Washington, D.C. Samina, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
All right. So the first question, why? why run for office and why at this particular time?
So I feel like the stakes have never been higher right now. We had an election about a year ago. We're taping this the day after Thanksgiving. I don't know if you guys are going to disclose that. But this didn't start on November 8, 2016. As far as I look at it, I've been a lifelong Democrat, and the Democrats have been losing for years.
Yep.
We've lost the White House. We've lost both houses of Congress. We've lost most state legislatures, most governor's mansions, including in this state. What we've been doing has not been working. So it is time for new leadership. It is time for me not to sit by and sort of point and say they're doing it wrong. It's time for people like me to put our names on the ballot and step up. And it's been really an incredible process of exploring the district and talking to voters and reconnecting with some of the people that I know through the nonprofit community and understanding what is missing in terms of leadership and the progressive leadership that's possible. And that's when I thought, it's time. I can be that progressive leader. We're hearing it directly from voters. We're talking to voters every single day. And what's even more heartening is that I recently got endorsed by the Justice Democrats, which is a national progressive organization that looked very hard at this district and said, okay, we're looking at the other challengers, the incumbent Mike Quigley, who has to date not been challenged since he got into office in 2009, and thought, we see what Samina sees. It's time for a progressive rep that is in touch with voters. And that's what's really powerful. We're getting this overwhelmingly positive response from voters. They want a progressive voice in Congress.
I'm actually curious about this. So given your past, you're a fairly social and out there person. However, like this whole gig, running for office, right? You have to talk to so many people. That has got to be, I mean, you're doing it every day, right?
Right.
You're out there shaking hands, talking to people. Like What is that experience like? What are you hearing, and is it different than maybe what you expected?
Yeah, I think initially I wasn't sure how people would respond to a primary challenge.
Right.
Like people would think, like, why would we do that? Why would you want to challenge?
Yeah, because Quigley's sort of an establishment Democrat guy, right? Yeah, okay.
Right, yeah, and he's been out there. It's just one of those things where we thought, oh, we're going to get all these people saying, no, you shouldn't do that.
Mm-hmm.
But we actually got, yes, we're ready for a progressive.
Hmm.
And it was, we got maybe, every time we go out, we probably talk to several hundred voters at a time. So it's almost like a mini poll.
Hmm.
And we get one person who's sort of like, nope, I'm with Quigley. And it's, that's not exactly an overwhelming response.
Right.
And, you know, whereas when I talk to people who are from the Ninth District, which is Jan Schakowsky's district, for example, and I tell people what I'm doing, they're like, oh, wow, if you ever ran against Jan, forget about it.
Yeah.
Like, that's the awareness and sort of the devotion is different. And so that also struck me as an important data point in terms of what kept me going and kept the team going and realizing, oh, there's an opportunity here.
Are you meeting Republicans?
I actually have.
And what's...
I had a conservative Republican sign my petition. Because
all right.
Because he saw, this is democracy. That's the other thing, is that a lot of the times we've been talking to people in the frame of getting signatures for petitions. That's the opportunity to talk to folks, right? And some of them aren't even aware of the process. How does a name get on the ballot?
Right.
Who decides what choices we have or don't have? And I think every January of an election cycle, there's some story of an incumbent kicking somebody off the ballot. It's sort of a badge of honor.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the average voter sort of sees that story and just ignores it because they're not part of that world. And we were just talking about this on the way down here. It's like most people aren't aware of that whole process, and it's kind of mysterious. And I think that's a tragedy. I think that's part of one of the reasons why I'm actually really excited to be talking to voters, is to educate them, like, here's how somebody gets on the ballot, and here's why you've had the choices you've had, because of the cost and the time and the process that is very much designed to preserve incumbency.
Yeah, so I'm a little more than halfway through the book Impeachment by Cass Sunstein, because he's going to be a guest on the podcast. And basically what you're saying is, like, our understanding of just the impeachment process is we don't understand it. But what the book seems to be sort of focused in is the writers of the Constitution, the one thing that was the most important thing is that we don't become a monarchy. That is all about the republic. And you have a great quote. You said, quote, if you're not at the table, you're on the menu.
Yeah, it's not mine, but I do like it. I don't know if it's Elizabeth Warren. It's a great quote. And I actually use that to talk to people from all communities because I realize that even though people might think, like, oh, I'm represented because there's a Democrat at the table, I said, but not all Democrats are created equal.
Yeah.
You know, we don't necessarily have a representative right now who speaks to the progressive voters in the district, which is the majority of the district.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, our current representative isn't even part of the Congressional Progressive Caucus. I think a lot of people would be surprised by that.
Mm-hmm.
But that is the truth. And it's one of those things where people are just assuming that there's a good guy and a bad guy. And the good guys wear blue and the bad guys wear red. And that's probably true in a Star Trek episode whatever. Or like, you know, in sort of sci-fi and Westerns. And we do have a very polarized political climate. But I want to remind people that we have to dream a little. We have to aspire and think about what could our leaders be and not just be in defense resistance mode, be in a mode where we're assertive. We have things that we care about and we're going to fight for them, and we're not just going to resist.
Yeah. Bernie Sollins, who co-founded Second City, had a great thing. He used to say that all politics is personal. So, like, his favorite political scenes at Second City were ones that really seemed like a fight between a wife and a husband, and then you figure out it's Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton or whatever. I'm wondering how that registers for you in the age where people talk about identity politics, which is this phrase that the look in your face right now,
yeah,
if the podcast listeners could see it, is basically how I feel too, which is like, oh my God, you're throwing that trope around so much. But I'm
Should
curious.
I tell you that I'm brown? I'm Muslim.
Yeah.
I'm a woman.
Mm-hmm.
I check so many boxes.
Mm-hmm.
So I am kind of the identity Pollock smorgasbord. That's me. that's what you get with me. But the reality is, I mean, going back to the statement, just as it is, you know, it is personal for me. I mean, I'm making this commitment. I've got my entire family and my friends and my entire network. I've left my job. This is what I'm focusing on full time. So it is personal in that sense. But if you want to put it in the frame of identity politics, I think the opportunity is to really look and see what was the 2016 election about? What have our last few elections been about? a lot of the issue with the 2016 election wasn't so much about, you know, we voted in a bigot. It's we voted in a guy who actually went to the states that we didn't go to.
Uh-huh.
That was one really big, you know, sort of omission from the Clinton campaign, right?
Yeah.
And so when I was thinking about how to process or feel about the 2016 election, I was scared.
Mm-hmm.
I'll be honest. I was scared for myself, for my family. And there was a part of me that just wanted to say, those people were bigots. I don't want to talk to them. I don't want to have to deal with them. But then I realized that's exactly why I should talk to them. I saw a Washington Post article sometime in 2016 that said most people don't know much about Muslims. They don't even know one.
Mm-hmm.
So all of their information is coming from other sources. And that's why they have the perceptions they do. And I thought, this is why I have to show up. I have to be visible and vocal and a little vulnerable because this is what is it's what's at stake.
That's an interesting. I mean, you do have to, the vulnerable piece is the interesting one, right? Because on the one hand, you would think as a politician that that's one thing you can't be at all. But it strikes me that the very best politicians, the very best communicators share their vulnerability and have this sort of empathetic viewpoint where they and the audience are it's sort of like an improv thing, right? Where you're in that conversation with the audience and you kind of have to be because you're reliant on each other.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the comedy analogy is a perfect one because
mm-hmm.
I feel like every time you are in a comedy scene or you're on stage, people cannot pretend that something's funny.
Mm-hmm.
You're seeing their authentic response
mm-hmm.
in a scene or to a joke. And that's what we got.
Yeah.
We got an authentic, unfiltered response to our political climate. And we don't like the outcome, but we have an opportunity to change the conversation. And that's why I'm running.
All right. So America elected an insult comedian.
Yeah, exactly.
Essentially, let's go with that.
We got Triumph
the insult. Yes.
Triumph the insult dog.
Just as president.
Exactly.
So you have a comedy background.
Yes.
What kind of comedian would we be electing if we elect you?
Actually, one that was doing things that were sort of not really focused on the comedy, but about representation and thinking about the relationship between a performer and her audience and thinking, what can I do to create an environment that's not a monoculture?
Yeah.
I've read a couple of Michael Pollan's books, so you have to excuse my use of the term monoculture, but it's one mm-hmm. of my favorite terms. But it's something that is so true in comedy and politics and in so many of our sectors, is that you see sort of the same people setting the narrative and the same people who are responding to it, and you think like, oh, everything's fine, everything's working. It's like, no, we have to think about what is our country? Our country is diverse. We have, even yesterday, I shared something about the National Day of Mourning. That's something that people don't think about. They think, oh, we're just having turkey and this is what this day is about. It's like, no, this is a day of abundance for some people and a day of loss for others.
Yeah.
And when it comes to comedy, the kind of comedian I am was always somebody who talked about social justice. You have to believe me, Kelly. It was funny.
I believe you.
But it was something that was really incredible. We would have comics who were African-American talk about sort of having people assume things about them. And we had, you know, women who were out and queer and people who made assumptions about them. And they made it funny and relatable because everybody knows what it's like to feel like an outsider.
Yeah. I first arrived at Second City in the late 80s when it was definitely still, you know, a boys club, very white. But I also was able in the mid 90s when I was producing to produce the very first gender equal cast. And that cast included Tina Fey.
Oh, wow.
And as you're talking, I'm thinking about what Tina did, because Tina, her perceptions about the female psyche are pretty incredible often, and you can see it pop up in her writing. But I just remember at that time, the tenor of the conversation of the shows changed because she did what you were doing. So I'm going to say you're the Tina Fey comedian compared to the insult comic. I hope that's okay with you.
That works.
That's not bad.
Successful career.
Yes, she's done well. But it is the true spirit of the improviser who is both they hold on to their point of view, but they are listening to the other person to actually understand their pain. And that's a thing I think was missing in this election as well, is that the holding on to the pain that existed felt inauthentic on the Democratic side. And then it was just, you know, crazy on the other side. There was just no controlling it. I think this was your quote, "The audience mirrors what's on stage."
Yeah.
Yeah. Talk to me about that, because that's a little bit of what we're talking about right now, I think.
Right, exactly. And I think that was a really exciting part of Simmer Brown, which is the comedy troupe that I co-founded. And we started with the thinking that we see a lot of shows in Chicago that are either all one type of performer or all one style. And we thought, let's bring everybody together. Hmm. And we know that we want stage time. Part of why you produce, right, is to be able to perform and get better. And we said, okay, we're going to get better. We're going to bring performers that don't normally perform together. Because there's a sort of unwritten rule that when you put together a stand-up comedy lineup, there's a diversity slot.
Yeah.
There's one.
Yeah.
And it can be a woman, a person of color, or someone who is LGBTQ. Mm-hmm. So you look at a scene like Chicago, as big as it is, the number of opportunities to perform are they're slim to none. So yeah. We thought, okay, let's not play those games and have those limits. We had one show that I was incredibly proud of. We had three women close out the show. Mm-hmm. And first of all, you almost never have a woman headliner, much less have three women who are closing out the show. Technically, they're not all the headliner, but I mean, we made a point to say, hey, we're going to have three women be the stars of this show. And we had the three pictures on the flyer. And that was important to me, because two of the women were women of color, and another woman was also a producer. So I thought, this is the kind of community I want to create. And it drew the same diversity off stage.
Yeah.
So that was that mirror of, hey, we like what you're doing. You're creating a universe that we like and we want to be a part of. And it was one of those things where we would get off stage, the show would be over, we'd be thanking people for coming, and they would be thanking us for doing the show.
Yeah.
And it's like, you paid to be here.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a powerful experience. And that also had an impact on me when I decided to pursue this path, was thinking, I know what it's like to be part of a movement, be part of a mindset of a mission-driven organization, a values-driven organization. And that's what I wanted to create with Simmer Brown, and that's what I want to create now with this campaign.
I'm thinking, too, you could never have known or guessed when you decided to run, and you're a woman. That we would be experiencing what we're experiencing right now in our culture. I mean, it's unprecedented in terms of the spotlight that's on just atrocious behavior by men and men in Congress. Has that been something that has, you know, that's catching up to you? You probably knew it was always there.
So some of the names are, you know, obviously bold-faced names that we all know. And some of them are local. There was just an article in the paper this week about somebody who was asked to step down. But that was an open secret.
Yeah.
How many open secrets can we allow, basically?
Right.
I knew about the one that was just a smaller theater here in Chicago. And
yep.
There was the profile story that happened last year that was
Louis C.K. Everyone knew about that.
Well, Louis C.K., I knew about that last year and had heard rumblings before, but there was actually an article in the Daily Beast quoting Roseanne Barr, less.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, Roseanne Barr has a huge name, and she put it out there.
She named the name.
There was another story from a really famous comedian, I'm going to draw a blank, Jen Kirkman.
Yeah.
She was making, kind of rumblings, but wouldn't name the name. But everybody knew who she was talking about.
Yeah.
And there's people like that in Chicago, too. There was a guy who was just outed for being a sexual predator. And he was on every stage in Chicago, every stage you can think of. He was getting the best opportunities.
Mm-hmm.
The subtext of all of this is, yes, this is, I was aware that this was ongoing. But what I really lament and mourn is, how many women did we not hear from?
Right.
How many senators, congresswomen, you know, comedy producers, actors, directors have we not heard from because of this? And that's where I really feel like is the opportunity. I was at the Jefferson Park CTA station collecting signatures, and it was the week of all of these admissions with Roy Moore and Al Franken, and a woman just signed my petition. She's like, you know what? It is our time.
Yeah.
And I knew exactly what she was talking about. We understood it completely, that what this moment was and what the opportunity was. And yet, you know, if you are a woman or a person of color, you're still like, oh, am I good enough? Is it time? Is it my turn? Or should I be doing this? Because that's what we've been told.
Right.
That it's not our turn. And then we're not good enough.
Yep.
And even the people who stumble, they say, oh, he just stumbled once. But what about the person who he literally stumbled on? Like, it's not fair to her.
Yeah. All right. We can't cover every issue that you want to cover. But I do want to talk to you a couple things. Let's talk about immigration. So this is, you know, I sit at a place where I do a lot of work in the behavioral science community, and I have interviewed neuroscientists, and we just posted a podcast with Robert Lustig, who talked about the fact that politicians and marketers are using propaganda tactics to prey on our fear. And this to me, the whole immigration debate is like insane, because it's preying on people's fear of the other, when in fact we need immigrants. We need them in our for healthcare. We need them like badly. I'm curious where you stand, especially in sort of being a potential progressive voice with the immigration debate.
Yeah, and I also want to take a step back from that and say, like, let's not think about immigrants as a means to an end either.
Yeah.
I mean, let's look at it as, you know, because there's always like, we're all immigrants. Not so fast. Mm-hmm. Some of us didn't choose to come here. Some of us were already here. As far as where the debate is now, I mean, my parents came here in the early 60s. My dad came here in 1962, and my mother came in 64. They actually came before the big Immigration Act of 1965, and so their arrival was very much based, it was very much a skills need in the U.S., that they were, you know, my dad's an engineer, my mother's a doctor, I mean, sort of very kind of stereotypical Indian immigrants, but, you know, we have sort of said, oh, those are the good brown immigrants. And then we sort of had this sort of dialogue or this discourse, which has been so so negative and been divisive. So the way I look at it, we have legislation right now that is specifically called the Clean Dream Act. And it's about, one, creating a path to citizenship. The other piece that's really kind of the underbelly of the immigration story is essentially mass incarceration at our borders. Mm-hmm. We've got detention facilities, and we've got, you know, we all heard the story about Sheriff Arpaio. Those conditions, that will continue under this administration, and that is a civil rights crisis. I mean, that is an incredible injustice. And so to me, it goes beyond even we need, you know, there's an economic justification. It's
sure.
What are our values?
There's a moral. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so to me, that's really the underpinning of it. And I feel like, where are we as a country? I mean, as far as our Illinois delegation, only two of our reps have been supportive of this Clean Dream, and it's actually been used as a wedge to say, okay, if you don't support this, you're not going to get a budget. So, like, that's a strong stance to take, and the rep in the 5th District is not one of those people. So it's one of those things where, you know, it's somewhat, unfortunately, tied to gerrymandering. I hate to go down the gerrymandering rabbit hole, but you look at the districts in this state, and they are very much drawn by race and party.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, in the 2010 census, I think it was the district was about 16% Latino. I'm sure that's gone up. But as far as, you know, the demographics of other districts like Luis Gutierrez, you know, the 4th District, they may not view it as like, oh, we don't have to be as strong on this because this isn't the demo we have to worry about. And that's unfortunate, is that we have people who are sort of pandering on those issues because of how our legislative districts are drawn out.
Let's talk about healthcare. So I was surprised that in this latest tax bill that they would go after healthcare again, because the outpouring against this, right, of taking away was so significant. Did that surprise you, or was this the only way they were going to get the money?
Yeah, I mean, this is they are relentless. This is
yes,
and they want their tax cuts. I mean, they are willing to accept a sexual predator, a predator of young girls, to get their tax cuts.
I don't even know what to. I know.
And to me, the healthcare discussion is one that, again, one where Democrats should be leading and not reacting.
Right.
And there is a bill, unfortunately, it's been sponsored by John Conyers, is the Medicare for All, H.R. 676, which I still think is a goal that we should be moving towards. There's more and more support for it. There's a lot of support for it in this district. I was at a meeting where the overwhelming majority of people were saying, it was 500, 600 people said, we need Medicare for All. And this is a policy that's obviously also been proposed by Bernie Sanders in the Senate bill. And this district went for Bernie Sanders in the presidential primary. So these kinds of progressive policies are where this district is more aligned. And so to me, that's one of those things where, one, it's the voters want it, and it's the right thing to do. My background in healthcare, I worked at a clinic that was federally funded. Mm-hmm. And so I saw clients who likely didn't have other resources when it came to healthcare. I myself, after leaving another job, didn't have healthcare for 6 months. That's actually how I ended up at Planned Parenthood. I needed a place to work. And so I went there because I didn't have I hadn't had a checkup in a while. I thought, let me just go get a checkup at Planned Parenthood. And they said, well, you know, we have an opening at our Westside clinic. So it sort of was this great kind of opportunity for me to say, hey, I know choice is important to me. I know women's health care is important to me. I get to do this as my job.
Mm-hmm. That's great. Living wage, pay equity. That's a thing. talk to us about your stance on that.
Yeah, to me, that's as someone who used to make minimum wage and roughly $7 an hour working at that Planned Parenthood, it is, there's a lot of people who are living on subsistence wages and barely getting by. And a lot of folks that I've been talking to, are especially in the, let's call it the sort of 22 to 35 age range, are cobbling several jobs together. And so the living wage issue really hits them hard because they have lots of different jobs that aren't paying particularly well. And so you have a lot of folks who are, you know, now confronting higher premiums for their insurance, and so they can't really afford them, and so they're making decisions. There was one incredibly heartbreaking story that just came out this week where a young man who just turned 26 cycled off his parents' insurance, was doing a GoFundMe for his insulin, and he died because he... Yeah. Couldn't afford it. I mean, like, that is just like, it breaks your heart. It's like, how in this country, how could we allow that?
Yeah. No. Well, all right. I'm going to ask you in a second for your yes and story. But before I do that, I know, I get it. Before I do that, I'm curious in terms of where you're at now in this cycle. All right. So you're still collecting signatures?
Yes.
Okay. How many more do you need?
Probably about, 500, 600 more. We're pretty close.
Oh, you're very close.
Yeah.
What's the next? Because you must look at this as sort of the arc of an entire campaign, and I don't know. So you get your signatures, then what happens?
So we are going to continue to talk to voters. We are starting to reach out to organizations that are local that will help with local endorsements. And so that I'm actually scheduling a lot of those meetings. I've got a couple of scheduled in early December already, mm-hmm. where I'm going to be presenting to people who are part of kind of like Democratic organizations that are on the progressive side. And that'll be another way for me to reach kind of the more active voter class. So sort of people who are more activists or people who are a little bit more, they're not, kind of just sort of casual observers. They probably worked on campaigns. And so people that are important to engage in terms of having allies on the ground.
Yeah, because you got a hill to climb. Yeah. The Sunstein book that I'm reading on impeachment talks about the fact that the way things are set up, they are set up to protect the people who are already there.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, and that, I think, had the outcomes over the last couple of weeks, you know, in the North Carolina elections, the Virginia elections. I mean, if we hadn't seen some of those outcomes, everyone would sort of probably felt like, oh, this is like insurmountable. But I also don't want to have this sigh of relief of like, oh, it's done, we're good. And the reality is there's a lot of work to be done. But what was really exciting to see, and this is something that I'm feeling heartened by, is that people are responding to candidates that are new to the process. A lot of first-time candidates won their seats, and they did so because they knew their area, their legislative district. They were talking directly to voters. They weren't, you know, kind of focusing on their identity. They were focusing on, hey, what do voters care about, and where do our values and our issues intersect? And let's talk about that, and have it be about our shared values, and not about, you know, are you, you know, kind of worried about my identity. The perfect example was a Virginia delegate, Danica Rome.
Yeah.
And she even said, she's like, you know, I'm talking to you about highway, you know, whatever highway it is, and my opponent's talking is worried about which bathroom I'm going to use.
Yeah, that was a great example. Yeah, she focused on the thing that people actually care about.
Yeah.
All right, the way we end the podcast is we ask our guest for a yes and story. So in improvisation, you're making something with your partner out of nothing, and you can't say no, and you can't say yes, but the only way to do this is to say yes and, to affirm and contribute. And I'm curious if you have a yes and story from your life.
Yes, and. Yes, and. Can we edit out the pause? yeah, no, I had, I think, probably the most powerful story that I can think of that I was taking some notes. We're going to edit this out, right?
Yeah.
was post-election. I think a lot of us were somewhat catatonic. But I knew that I had to do something. Mm-hmm. And I was reaching out to people and talking to people and saying, what can I do? And another comedian reached out to me and said, we are both working on diverse shows. What can we do together? So we had a breakfast together. We had this amazing conversation. And we were both talking about how we really want to make sure women of color are given an opportunity on stage. That was something that was really something I was focused on with Simmer Brown. People started to notice that I was booking a lot of the women of color. Like, oh, Samina, you're a good gauge for who we should book. But I realized I wasn't seeing as many women on stage. And I ran an open mic, too. So I was like, I actually know what the pipeline is. And I thought, instead of sort of constantly racking our brains or trying to figure out, you know, why there aren't more, why don't we do something about it? So we collaborated on a workshop that happened just a few weeks after the inauguration, where I think everyone is sort of, again, still somewhat reeling. And it was at a place in Hyde Park, the Silver Room, that we just had 25 women, and they were from different backgrounds. There was a woman there who's wearing a headscarf. There were, you know, Latinas, African-American women, all backgrounds. And it was, I kept saying to someone, I said, I wish we had taken before and after pictures, because it was literally like everyone left there with a glow on their face.
Right.
They were just so happy to be in a space where they felt they could be heard, that it was safe to say with how they really felt about performing and share how they, you know, share something funny and mm-hmm. just be themselves and be authentic. And that was a really powerful experience. And that was one of the highlights post-election, where I felt like, oh, this is what it's about. It's about creating a space where people feel not only heard, but that they're safe in not a safe, you know, snowflake way, but kind of like, it's okay. Whatever way you feel is okay. Show up as authentically as you want to be there, and we will accept you. And it's something that stays with me, because I think that is fundamentally what's missing for a lot of people, is feeling like they don't have a voice, that no matter what they do, it's not going to make a difference. People feel powerless right now. And so when you give people a space to feel like they can say what they want and they can be heard, that's incredibly empowering. And that's what this is all about.
Love it. Okay, if people want to find out more about you and give you money and things like that,
they can go to SaminaForCongress.com. That's SameenaForCongress.com.
Thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
Working in a coal mine, going down, down. Working in a coal mine, going down, down.